me something.
Oh, I'm trying to come up with a witty title. I just put it.
Models, we had a massage. I called it Massage et Joie. At a national meeting. That was the title of the presentation. So, I think you can move on from
it. Did she take it? No, she doesn't
have it. Well,
did they not have maybe it's in that drawer. That's weird. Somebody ran off with it. Anyway.
Don't click her, you just had it.
Can you do it? Is there a
button? No.
Oh, here it is, on the side.
It fell onto the. It fell in the hole.
Before we, I start. I just want to. Robin and I would really like you all to do your evaluations for the class. I think it's open now, and we'd really like to have your feedback as to what you thought would work and what you thought didn't work. Because it's, again, this is the first time we've taught this class, graduate students, undergraduate students together. So please be as open as you can be, and let us know what you would recommend, the way you would recommend. We'd like to see
that. Nobody wants us to evaluate you.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh, no, but you can just put comments into the whole thing for everybody, kind of, like, you know, just write their names down. It's as a whole. Class as a whole.
It is, yeah.
It is sad.
But you have an open response part.
Yeah.
You can even write right. McCarthy right. And all the
different. Strongly agree.
You can, I'll forward that all to Robin.
Yeah, but then everybody wants to see, like, McCarthy and everybody, yeah. Esther, so we can do the whole class.
Yep, exactly. So our lab, again, we are interested in looking at the in vivo function of muscle. And you've already saw the jumping frogs. But the jumping frogs were fun, but they weren't really 12-foot translational for us when it came to muscle injury and adaptation, because we're more concerned about adaptation and injury. And we started off with rabbit models because they're larger. And one thing we learned, this was out of 30-some rabbits. One ran on a treadmill. If you want to call that running on a treadmill.
Why is he army crawling?
Because he's a rabbit. On a treadmill. Right. So we soon learned that we couldn't exercise our rabbits on a treadmill. That's what we learned. So currently, what we do is what we're looking for is trying to understand how muscle functions in vivo and how muscle adapts to that function. So. One of the things that we discover is that a lot of the literature on muscle injury adaptation, especially eccentric exercise, has been formulated using single muscle fibers, in vitro, ex vivo sort of experiments. And we're pretty sure that muscle acts differently when it's inside the body. And so we have the ability to do some motion capture, to get some joint angles, to get kinematic data, simultaneously getting EMG. So we have EMG electrodes in the bicep, femoris, fascia lateralis, the tibialis anterior, and the medial gastrocnemius of the hind limb of this rat. And he was an ankle sprain model. He sprained his ankle. I think the hip people and the ankle people should get together, because then they can complain about the research and get more press. And this is one I put in just for Robin. We didn't do this, and I really wish we did. Because
is this a crayfish?
Is this a crayfish?
It's a shrimp.
It's a shrimp. All right.
Billy and I watched this for like 25 minutes in the lab. Let's
try to get this down here.
It might not play.
It might not play.
It's not on the internet.
It has to play.
You can just tell us.
If we can get out of the slideshow mode.
Yep. Hang on.
Over here. It's got me interested.
Back over here.
It's really funny.
Hopefully it's not me and my bicycle.
No.
Yeah. So, let's see. It still wants to be there, doesn't it?
Maybe it's not on the internet. Something happened.
I think you have to get out of slideshow.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Really trying to.
Isn't that weird? How
escape?
Well, I know that for some reason I had three different things for it, but it shouldn't.
Oh, there we go. Oh, the shrimp on the treadmill.
Shrimp on the board.
Oh, my. Yeah. It's really funny.
So we like to build a lot of things in our lab, and I wish we would have built the underwater treadmill for shrimp.
So beautiful.
For those of you that think this can't be funny, this is funded by the NSF, actually.
Yeah.
The government's funding.
South Carolina.
So, yeah. No, it's an awesome study, and it's very relevant to water quality.
What did you learn?
Look at that.
How do they decide what life means? Is
that cool?
Motor control study of shrimp. I don't know.
I think originally that was in South Carolina, at Charleston, and he was looking at oxygen consumption. And he had a closed chamber, so he could actually look
really
at
matter which life was running.
You know, exercise and metabolism.
To do this, right?
Wow. That's fantastic.
Oh, the best of people is a cat.
It's cool.
It's cool. Is it,
very cool.
It's really fun.
The problem is the wire's short out in water.
Yeah, the EMG is working.
And then there's the
right.
And so what we want to do is, and what we've been doing now on and off for about 12 years, is trying to investigate how the muscle responds to eccentric exercise. Because the muscle's designed, it's mechanically built to withstand force while producing, withstand strain while producing high forces. Its job is to act eccentrically. We all perform over all of our actions in our muscles over 50% of our time eccentrically. So that's what the muscles are designed for. And so when the people that do in vitro work in the 80s said that every time you pull on a muscle eccentrically, you're going to rip it in half, that really didn't seem logical or make a lot of sense to us. So we do a lot of instrumentation of the animals in vivo. And so we make our own electrodes. These are nerve cup electrodes that we'll put over top of the nerves. And the one on the left is for a thyroarytenoid muscle, which is a laryngeal muscle. This is a rabbit, a rat TA fronial nerve cuff. And then the one on the right is a rabbit TA nerve cuff. And if you separate the bicep femoris and the semimembranosus on the back side of the leg of a rabbit or a rat, you'll come upon the sciatic nerve, which then branches into the tibial groin. So if you want to control the plantar flexors, you put that cuff over the tibial nerve. If you want to control the dorsiflexors, you put it over top of the fronial nerve. You staple them shut after you have it on, you tie it on. So inside the cuff, which is sialastic tubing, is stainless steel Kuhner medical wire, which is denuded, so that when you use a stimulator, it will cause depolarization of the motor nerves. To measure force, we make our own strain gauges. So these are titanium, E-shaped buccal transducers. These are just the backbones of those. This is for a rat gastroc or Achilles tendon. This is for a rabbit TA, and that's for a cat Achilles tendon. We then put these semiconductor strain gauges over here on the right-hand side. On each side of this gauge, so we'll put one on this side of the backbone and one on the opposite side of the backbone. And then when you put these together, these are glued on. So you have one on each side, two wires, and make what's called half bridge strain configuration, so that whenever you have this backbone that bends, one side goes into compression, the other side goes into positive strain. And so when you run electrical current through here, a very low 5 volts DC current, that changing compression or strain of these semiconductors changes the distance, so then you have an output voltage that changes. You have them balanced when you make them, you put them on the tendon, and you run the tendon through like so. So when the tendon has a tension, it causes that buckle to bend. And when that buckle bends, you have an output that changes the voltage.
So it's not bending this way, it's bending sideways.
Yep. So the E is actually going this way, and so it's just deforming it in sort of this direction, which the backbone actually bends. And it's very subtle, and they're very, very sensitive, so it's a very subtle thing. This is how you actually calibrate it. You put the stringer that you want through it the same way and hang weights off it. When you hang a weight off it, you get a voltage output, and you can calibrate that to force. As long as you have a really good, repeatable calibration, you're really, really reliable for force production.
Does that change? I mean, I know it's just like a slight curve, but does that change the function of the tendon at all?
Likely.
It probably does. We never had any injuries from it, but we do find changes in the compliance of the tendon being done. So there's been a couple studies in humans that have used these in wrist functions. During surgery, kind of like Benyon did with the ACL back in the day. So they probably had some excessive strain on the tendon.
So is that, why would one not maybe, I don't know, if it's feasible, cut the tendon and tie it off on and have it pull like a force transducer that way?
After the fact or during the study?
Or during the study, I guess.
Yeah, so let me do. So the in situ stuff's been done in the past where it will, they'll cut off the calcaneus or a portion of the bone, they'll attach it to a servo motor, and then they'll be able to control the length of strain. But we wanted to measure it all in vivo during normal ambulation or during exercise.
Oh, you can't really leave them in the animal.
That would think, yeah. So there have been chronic studies. We have implanted these in rats, then externalized them, and then walked them every other day or so, and got 6-month data off of walking animals before. Mostly in cats because they're larger. The smaller the animal, you know, creates a bigger challenge to do this kind of stuff. So we use the TA and the EDL. So because we want to be able to assess adaptation and damage and the variables that induce those things, well, we use the TA and the EDL because they're, I mentioned it before, they're architecturally disparate muscles. The TA has 50 millimeter long fibers. It has almost no pronation angle. And the EDL has about 15 or 20 millimeter long fibers. It's highly pronated. So two completely architecturally different systems, and we can measure force and strain in both of them. So when the rabbit's anesthetized and all the wires are coming out, the foot will be positioned onto the foot plate. And that's the camera, the servo motor, and there's a torque sensor on that one. So now we have torque of the entire system. We have force of the TA. And between the two, we can eke out the force of the EDL as well. And I should mention this as well. The sternomicrometry that we use here, by the way, the green arrows are in the EDL. The blue wires are in the TA. These are ultrasound. This is piezoelectric current. So they're sending sound signals at 498 pings per second. And we know the velocity of transmission of sound in muscle. And if you know that, you know how long it takes for the sound to reach one person to another one, you'll know the distance between it. And that's how we get real-time length change. And that's the experimental setup. The rabbit anesthetized. The computer programs that we write synchronize the movement of the foot with the stimulation of the muscle as well, so you can do concentric, eccentric, isometric contractions. So here's what we refer to this as a constrained in vivo, because everything is still intact. It's natural physiological perfusion of the tissues. The moment arm is still relevant, you're doing an angle joint change with muscle strain. So we call it a strain in vivo. As opposed to the unconstrained in vivo that we normally see in treadmill walking. So here's what 10 eccentric contractions would look like. We have 100% supermaximal stimulation. All the motor units are firing synchronously, which isn't physiologic, but at least we have repeatable force, repeatable movement. The next one is going to be slow motion. So you can see we also do 100 millisecond pre-activation. So you'll see the muscle contract first before the foot plates move down. So actually the muscle, and we do that all the time whenever we move, we have to pre-activate our muscles all the time, and that stiffens our tendons. Allows us to absorb energy better. So we did a 100 millisecond pre-activation before we actually have the 500 millisecond eccentric contraction. Now we can measure force and strain for every repetition for 5 sets of 10 or 7 sets of 10. So in the top trace is the length change of the tibialis anterior. This is the length change of your EDL. This is the sensor output voltage. This comes from the torque sensor. And then this is the buffer output. You see that's in volts, because that's how the strain gauges work. You put volts in, you get volts out, depending on how the resistance changes from bending. And we can calibrate that to force and torque after the fact. But one thing I want to notice, this is actually two eccentric contractions, those traces. And these are the colors of what those truly are. This is actually that 100 millisecond eccentric contraction. Blue. And so you'll see the very first 100 milliseconds, you'll notice that the length change of the TA changes, the EDL changes, and you have force output from the tendon of the TA, and you have torque being produced as a torque sensor for the entire dorsiflexion. You'll notice that both the TA and the EDL shorten, even though it's an isometric contraction. So isometric contractions are supposed to be no length change. This should probably be defined as no joint angle change, because internally, the tendons have compliance, the muscles shorten, the tendon lengthens. Right? We've talked about that before. And that's what happens in the beginning portion of this exercise battle. The second part's in red, and I have it as active fiber strain here because that's supposed to be the strain that causes injury in eccentric contractions. And you'll notice that the strains are not really very high in vivo. In situ, researchers have subjected muscle fibers and muscles to 60% strain from their resting length, which causes damage. And we are nowhere near 60% strain in vivo, which is range of motion. In fact, we don't even get the 30% strain. You might get the 30% strain sometimes, but it also depends on where you utilize your starting point to calculate strain, which is a change in length. If we're going to use the starting length as change in length, we never even stretch it back to the starting length. If we use this length here, we might get 30% strain at the most. The last part is relaxation. The muscle is relaxed, returned back to its starting length. Just to show you that the triangles of the EDL active strain and its change in length over the original length, and this is the TA. You notice that the TA never strained over 10%, and the TA is pretty consistent across 50 repetitions. The EDL strain does increase a little bit over time. It gets up to 25%, 28%. We're still nowhere near what the old injury data used to show when you had single fibers and petri dishes. And I put these here for you. We're looking at right now how active fiber shortening and active fiber strain together. So this is the strain that you just saw a minute ago in red, the actual positive lengthening of the fiber on the top. And this down here is in blue. This is actually the fiber shortening. And what's really neat that we find is that it seems like the fiber is pretty much shortened, a magnitude that's almost consistent with how much they actively strain during the eccentric phase of the contraction. So even if we have a 20% strain in our fiber, because of the compliance of the system, the muscles allow it to shorten almost an equidistant amount before it gets trained back to its resting length. So ultimately, we don't have these systems where these fibers are constantly subjected to these really, really, really large strains that are going to cause injury. This is the torque that the TA and the EDL produce together. This is the force of the EDL as expected because it's a short fibered muscle. It actually has a peak and it actually produces less force at the long and short ends. And the bottom of the TA being a long muscle fiber, low pronation angle, it produces almost constant force across its entire length. I just want to show you, this is what we do right now, trying to associate adaptation and or injury to work as opposed to fiber strain or force, because work is a more relevant variable. Blue is the 100 millisecond shortening phase. And when you make a work loop, it's a matter of just looking at force and fiber length changes or muscle length changes together. And when you go in a clockwise loop, you're going to have some negative work. You shouldn't have any eccentric contractions. So here's shortening of the fiber, the force production, and all this area underneath this curve is positive work. This is shortening muscle fiber and force. And then when you get to the eccentric phase, which is red, you have a lengthening of the fiber, right, across the y-axis, and this is all negative work. These eccentric contractions absorb energy. And then when the muscle relaxes, it still lengthens the fibers farther because of the elastic recoil of the tendon. And then you have to subtract positive work from negative work, and you get that work. And this is what we propose to be a more important variable when it comes to adaptation injuries, the network of the muscle. When you compare EDL and TA, the EDL is here on the left, and TA is on the right. And a network of 263 Newton millimeters compared to 111. A significant difference for two muscles that are synergist muscles.
How does injury or fatigue change that? How would a muscle, what would the network look like?
after 10:23? Great question.
Thanks.
So here's number one, right? And here's number 10. So after 10 or 15 alone, the shape of the curve stays a lot the same. What we find that changes the most is obviously the force production from the fatigue and the compliance of the tendon, so that some of this green part here, which is the recoil, changes over time, especially more in the TA. But otherwise, the shape doesn't change a whole lot. But the network will decrease a lot because there's a change also in the positive work, but it's the negative work that changes the most. In fact, here's negative work over time. TA, which are the EDL and TA. TA again, stays pretty consistent. The EDL looks like it displays a greater reduction, but overall, they're basically the same. They're dropping about 50% or so, 75%. Both of them, even though it looks different, but the TA just starts off lower. So again, the EDL is a triangle, TA is in black. But what I wanted to show you with this is that we get all these data for every single repetition of an exercise bout, not just a pre and post measurement, which is what you sometimes end up getting with in situ protocols.
So kind of related to Kate's question, you know, over time, but if you let him rest for like 20 minutes and you repeated it, would it be the same?
Won't be the same because the reduction in force in our protocol is partly due to fatigue and part of it's due to damage and injury.
Okay.
And so what we hope to eke out of this is because if isometric force is more sensitive to fatigue than eccentric force is. We use isometric force more as a marker of fatigue and the eccentric force more as a marker of injury. And what we haven't done yet, what we need to do yet as well, is we can instrument animals like this as well now with rats. We've made the system smaller now. And we can do this every other day for months and see what happens. And then we can look at how the ability to produce force changes when adaptations take place and then those injuries or those fatigues don't happen anymore. And lastly, this is just something, this is what we're working on. Currently, this is what we published about 7 years ago, which was our idea that cellular proteostasis and mechanical equilibrium are related to each other. Because we're a muscle mechanics lab, but cell biology makes the world go around, it seems like muscle. So we're trying to think about how we're mechanically perturbing these systems, but what happens at the cellular level that makes them change over time. And I leave you with people was given to me a long time ago. For all grad students and undergraduate students that may find this helpful.
Girl shrinkers. Great.
If you don't know Jorge Cham, he was here about 10 years ago or so, came to visit. The guy that does PhDcomics.com. Came by and gave a talk.
I wasted so many hours.
Rightfully so.
They're all on there. You can go back forever.
Yeah. It was fun.
It's very good. Masters. Yeah. More. Yes. Right. Pile the heap deeper. I love it. It's hilarious.
So, any questions I can answer for you? Ideas or thoughts? Sorry, Robin, I went a little bit long.
Oh, no problem.
Well, you know, the challenge is always what's funded and what has to take the priority in a laboratory and what's not funded. So we don't have funding for this yet. So this is always something that has to come along whenever we have the time and the extra resources to have here and there. But the next thing, we have a study on the velocity. We have some data already on how velocity of eccentric contraction changes fiber strength, because that hasn't been answered very well yet. So we do find that we can increase the rate of fiber strain and we can increase the rate of force production every single time we do an eccentric contraction faster and faster and faster, but the magnitude of the strain never changes. And the damage doesn't seem to change either. And that fits with the force velocity curve anyway. So what we'd like to do is what we just mentioned a minute ago, which is instrument these rats, exercise them on a long-term basis and see how these variables change. But that's a dissertation for somebody because that's a lot of data. A lot of time, but it'd be good. It's a lot of stuff that we can do. We have the equipment and stuff.
So, do you think it might vary with the nerve stimulation too? if you went lower frequency versus...
Maybe. That's always a challenge. The way we stimulate them, we have to stimulate them 100%, but at least we know what we're going to be stimulating. We can prepare them all back. It's so non-physiological. That's part of the challenge. We know that the damage we'll get in the muscle is often partly due to the way we stimulate it, which is 100% super maximum efficient of time. Because we're inducing some shearing in there that wouldn't normally happen under normal cerebral control or motor control. But the only way to get around it would be to use a whole bunch of different kind of multiple stimulators and utilize some kind of a frequency system in which we could do some low frequency, high frequency stimulation. But that adds so much kind of variability that